A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hey, Herman and Corin. One of my aspirations for the My Word Prompts podcast is I've been 37 years knocking about the planet. And during that time, I've gone down countless weird rabbit holes on the internet, starting from when the internet had modem dial-up sounds. So part of the stuff in this podcast is educative information about serious topics like AI. But I'm also trying to work my way back gradually through a lifelong quest of weird rabbit holes on the internet. And now and again, I see something on my feed and I say, wait, this is a thing I've looked at before. We need to cover this. So it was that I was looking at Facebook today and I came across footage of illicit Chinese officers. MI5 busted them, the British Domestic Intelligence Service. And basically what you see in their undercover video is two Chinese police officer is trying to lure a woman out of an apartment because she's wanted by the Chinese state. Now, this isn't an isolated incident, but rather it's a rare caught-on-video moment of something that's been reported on for years, namely that China operates this global network of illegal, super shady police stations, and it's literally what it sounds like. The PRC, using diplomatic immunity, often these operate under diplomatic cover or to the sides of it, position police stations overseas, and they're often trying to clamp down on Chinese dissidents. They follow them out of China and keep tabs on them. Sometimes there is an espionage element to it, but this is a phenomenon that's been documented around the world, and naturally, this isn't something done with the consent or coordination of host governments, who generally don't want illicit police stations of foreign countries to operate on their turf. But China does it anyway and gets away with it as much as they possibly can. Let's talk about this strange world, Herman and Corin. I've read some startling estimates as to how many illicit they're not fake police stations, that's the thing. Depending on what way you look at it, they're illicit police stations. But these are operated by China with the intention of actually serving some purpose. How far does this network expand? How long has this been going on? And how do you even police this kind of thing if you are the MI5 or a country? When we think about counterintelligence, we usually think about trying to frustrate intelligence gathering by foreign adversaries targeting your country. But what do you do when a foreign country is trying to just target its own citizens overseas in your country? Over to you two.
Daniel was scrolling Facebook, as one does, and he sends us this video. MI5 undercover footage. Two Chinese officers outside a London apartment trying to lure a woman out. They're telling her she's wanted for economic crimes back in China. MI5 intercepted it, expelled the officers, and released the video. And Daniel's reaction was basically, wait, I've read about this for years, but here it is, caught on camera.
That's what makes this footage so significant. We've had reports, investigations, academic papers, but a verified intelligence agency releasing operational video? That's rare. It transforms something that can be dismissed as allegations into something visually undeniable. Two officers, plain clothes but clearly operating in an official capacity on British soil, attempting to coerce a Chinese national out of her home.
There's something about seeing it that changes the psychological register, right? Reading a report about illicit police stations, your brain files it under concerning but abstract. But watching two men stand outside a real apartment building, on a real London street, speaking through a real intercom to a real woman inside, suddenly, it's not abstract at all. It's a Tuesday afternoon, and there are foreign police at your door.
That's the power of operational footage. It collapses the distance between this is happening somewhere and this is happening here. And I think that's exactly why MI5 released it. They wanted the visceral reaction, not just the diplomatic one.
Daniel's prompt, boiled down, is this. China operates a global network of illicit overseas police stations. They use diplomatic cover. They target dissidents and activists, and they do it without host government consent. He wants to know how far this network extends, how long it's been happening, and the tricky part, how a country like the UK even polices this kind of thing when the targets aren't British citizens but foreign nationals on British soil. Also, by the way, DeepSeek V4 Pro is writing our script today.
Fitting, given the subject matter. A Chinese AI writing about Chinese overseas policing operations. I appreciate the symmetry.
Let's not get too meta. The point is, this video isn't an isolated incident. It's a rare visual confirmation of something that's been documented for years across dozens of countries.
That's why we need to define what we're actually talking about here. Because the phrase illicit police station sounds almost cartoonish, like someone set up a precinct in a warehouse with a sign on the door. But the reality is more insidious and harder to spot.
These aren't buildings with Chinese police logos and a front desk. They're physical locations, often tucked into commercial buildings, residential apartments, sometimes the back rooms of restaurants or cultural centers, where officers from China's Ministry of Public Security operate without the host government's authorization. Sometimes they're one or two officers. Sometimes it's a larger team. But the key element is that they're conducting official police business on foreign soil, and nobody in the host country signed off on it.
That distinction from normal consular services is critical. When you walk into a legitimate Chinese consulate, you're interacting with diplomatic staff who have been accredited by the host government. Their roles are defined under the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations. They can issue visas, notarize documents, assist citizens in distress. But these illicit stations do something entirely different. They conduct investigations, interrogations, surveillance operations. They confiscate passports. They pressure people to return to China voluntarily. That's not consular assistance. That's extraterritorial law enforcement.
Think of it this way. A consulate is like a customer service desk for citizens abroad. You go there, you get your paperwork done, you leave. An illicit police station is more like a detective's office hidden behind a storefront. You don't go there voluntarily. They come to you. Or they lure you there under false pretenses. The direction of the interaction is completely reversed.
The diplomatic cover mechanism is what makes this so difficult to counter. These stations are often registered as cultural centers, trade promotion offices, or consular annexes. They leverage the legal protections of diplomatic immunity, not always directly, but in a gray zone where the threat of diplomatic fallout makes host governments hesitant to raid what looks, on paper, like a legitimate facility.
Cultural center is such a perfect cover because it's inherently vague. What does a cultural center do? It hosts events. It promotes language learning. It builds community ties. All perfectly normal. All completely unremarkable. So if you're an intelligence agency and you see Chinese officers going in and out of a building, registered as a cultural center, that's not automatically suspicious. They could be attending a calligraphy class. The cover story does half the work for them.
The Australian Strategic Policy Institute, ASP, published a major report on this in 2023. They identified at least 110 of these illicit stations operating across 53 countries. That's the documented floor, by the way. The actual number is almost certainly higher. And that report was a watershed because it moved the conversation from scattered anecdotes to a systematic global picture.
110 is the number they could confirm through open-source intelligence, leaked documents, and witness testimony. But think about the methodology problem here. SBI can't exactly send researchers to knock on doors in 53 countries and ask, "Excuse me, is there an unregistered Chinese police station in this building?" They're working with what surfaces. The real number could be double that, easily.
That's before you account for the stations that don't have a fixed physical location at all. Some of these operations are mobile. Officers rotate through different cities, use temporary meeting spaces, conduct their business in hotel lobbies or borrowed offices. Those are much harder to count.
When Daniel asks, "What is this really about?" the answer is, China has built a parallel policing infrastructure that extends its domestic security apparatus into sovereign nations, hidden behind a patchwork of diplomatic and commercial cover stories, targeting its own citizens who thought they'd escape Beijing's reach by leaving the country. The MI5 video just confirmed what investigators and journalists had been piecing together for years.
That MI5 operation itself is worth walking through because it reveals the operational playbook in real time. Late 2025, these two officers show up at a residential building in London. They're not in uniform, plain clothes, no visible identification. They knock on the door, they tell this woman through the intercom that she's wanted for economic crimes in China, and they try to convince her to come outside and talk. What they didn't know was MI5 had been watching.
This is what I find darkly satisfying about the whole thing, the counter-surveillance aspect. MI5 didn't just hear about this after the fact. They were positioned to film it, which means they'd identified the officers, tracked their movements, and anticipated the approach. That's not a reactive bust. That's months of intelligence work, culminating in catching them mid-operation.
And once MI5 had the footage, they moved fast, expelled both officers, made the diplomatic notification, and then took the unusual step of releasing the video publicly. That last part is a signal. Intelligence agencies don't typically broadcast operational footage. Doing so tells Beijing, we see what you're doing, we can document it, and we're willing to embarrass you over it.
There's also a deterrent logic here that's worth unpacking. Releasing the footage doesn't just embarrass Beijing. It warns the diaspora community that this is happening, and it tells Chinese officers operating overseas that their operational security isn't as good as they think it is. Every officer running one of these stations now has to wonder, is my host country's intelligence service filming me right now? That uncertainty is its own form of countermeasure.
It's the intelligence equivalent of turning the lights on in a room full of cockroaches. The cockroaches don't die, but they scatter, and they know they've been seen.
Let's trace how we got here, because Daniel asked how long this has been going on, and the answer is longer than most people realize. The first documented cases that broke into Western media were 2018, the Netherlands and Germany. Dutch authorities discovered Chinese police operating out of a restaurant in Amsterdam, interviewing Chinese citizens about their political activities back home. German investigators found similar setups in Berlin and Frankfurt around the same time.
What's notable about those early cases is how confused the initial response was. Local authorities weren't sure what they were looking at. Was this a criminal extortion ring? A diplomatic misunderstanding? Some kind of private security operation? The concept of a foreign police force operating on your soil without permission was so outside the normal framework that it took a while just to categorize the problem.
It's like if you found a French gendarme directing traffic in Chicago. Your first reaction isn't, an extraterritorial policing operation. Your first reaction is, why is there a French police officer in Chicago and what is happening? The cognitive dissonance buys time for the operators.
Then, in 2020, The Guardian did a major investigation that really cracked this open. They uncovered a network the Chinese government was calling Overseas Police Service Centers. The branding is almost clever in its blandness. Service centers sounds like a place you'd go to renew a driver's license. But The Guardian's reporting showed these centers were actively tracking down Chinese dissidents, conducting interrogations, and pressuring people to return to China. The investigation identified stations across Europe, North America, and Australia.
Overseas Police Service Center is a brilliant piece of bureaucratic language. It contains the word police, so Beijing can say they were never hiding anything. But it frames the whole operation as a helpful service. Who could object to a service center? It's like calling a surveillance hub a community safety assistance point. The language is designed to make the objection sound unreasonable before you've even made it.
The operational model is what makes this so hard to spot. These officers don't set up a police station with a sign. They embed themselves in existing Chinese community networks. They use WeChat, the ubiquitous messaging app for the Chinese diaspora, to identify targets. They monitor social media, they cultivate informants within local Chinese business associations and student groups, and they build dossiers on individuals they consider threats.
WeChat is the linchpin here, and it's worth understanding why. For the Chinese diaspora, WeChat isn't just a messaging app, it's the entire digital ecosystem. It's how you talk to your family back home, how you pay for things, how you join community groups, how you find out about local events. If you're a Chinese national living abroad, your social graph is probably on WeChat. And Beijing has complete access to that data. So an officer running a station in London can map someone's entire social network, who they talk to, what groups they're in, what they're saying, before they ever make contact.
Once they identify a target, the approach is calibrated to stay in a legal gray zone. They'll reach out through a community contact, someone the target might trust. They'll propose a friendly meeting, maybe at a cultural center or a restaurant. Then they confiscate the person's Chinese passport. They might tell them their family back home is under investigation, or that there's a warrant that can be resolved if they just cooperate. The goal is to make returning to China voluntary, but the coercion is unmistakable.
Let me give you a concrete scenario, because this is where the abstraction breaks down into something very real. Imagine you're a Chinese graduate student in London. You've been mildly critical of the government online. Nothing dramatic, just sharing some articles, maybe commenting on a protest. One day, a respected member of the local Chinese business community reaches out. He says he'd love to get coffee, talk about your career plans, maybe connect you with some opportunities. You show up. There's another person there you haven't met. The conversation drifts. They mention your parents' names. They mention that your father's government job has a security review coming up. They mention that there's a warrant with your name on it back home, but it can all be sorted out if you just come back and have a conversation. Nobody's raised their voice. Nobody's made an explicit threat, but you understand exactly what's happening.
That's the genius of the approach from an operational standpoint. If you try to explain that interaction to local police, what do you say? I had coffee with some people and they said some things that made me uncomfortable. That's not a crime. There's no smoking gun. But the person who experienced it knows they've been threatened, and the chilling effect is just as powerful as if they'd been handcuffed.
The passport confiscation is a key tactic. Chinese law requires citizens to use Chinese travel documents for international travel. If an officer takes your passport and you're a Chinese national living abroad, you're suddenly trapped. You can't travel. You can't prove legal status easily, and your home country's consulate won't help you, because they're the ones who took it. It's an elegantly brutal pressure point.
It exploits a vulnerability that most people don't think about until it happens to them. Your passport is your exit ticket. Without it, you're not just inconvenienced, you're territorially confined. You can't cross borders. In some cases, you can't even prove you're in the country legally if you're on a visa tied to that passport. It's a form of administrative detention without walls.
Which brings us to the legal gray zone China exploits. Beijing's official position is that these are voluntary service points for Chinese citizens, essentially community outreach. They argue that Chinese law permits public security officers to assist citizens abroad, and that nobody is being coerced. But host nations have documented interrogations, surveillance, passport seizures, and threats against family members. That's not community outreach. That's extrajudicial policing.
Beijing's defense is clever because it forces the accuser to prove a negative. How do you prove someone wasn't there voluntarily? How do you prove the conversation was coercive rather than helpful? The burden of proof falls on the host country, and the evidence is often testimonial, one person's word against another's, complicated by fear and language barriers, and the very real concern about retaliation.
The New York case from 2024 puts this in stark relief. Federal investigators discovered a Chinese police station operating out of a basement in Flushing, Queens. The target list was specific: Falun Gong practitioners, Uyghur activists, and Chinese Christians. The station had surveillance equipment, files on individual dissidents, and documentation of efforts to track their movements and pressure them to stop their activities. This wasn't a cultural center that had overstepped. It was an operational intelligence gathering and intimidation hub.
Flushing matters because it's one of the largest Chinese diaspora communities in the United States. These stations aren't placed randomly. They're positioned where the target populations live. The officers build relationships with local business owners. They attend community events. They gather intelligence through social networks that have been cultivated over years.
What's your sense of how they actually recruit those local contacts? Because that's a piece of this I find fascinating. You're a restaurant owner in Flushing. You've been there for 20 years. You're part of the community. How does a Chinese police officer approach you and say, "By the way, I need you to keep an eye on some people for me"?
From what researchers have documented, it's rarely that direct. It starts with genuine community engagement. The officers show up at events, they're friendly, they offer help with bureaucratic problems, they position themselves as a bridge to the consulate. Over time, they identify people who are either ideologically sympathetic or practically vulnerable, someone whose business depends on imports from China, someone with family members whose government jobs could be affected. Then the ask starts small. We're just trying to understand the community better. Can you tell us about the groups that meet at the community center? It escalates gradually. By the time it's clearly intelligence gathering, the person is already compromised.
It's not recruitment in the spy novel sense. It's more like cultivation. You plant the relationship, water it with genuine favors and assistance, and then slowly bend it toward your operational needs. The person might not even think of themselves as an informant. They're just helping out. Someone who's been helpful to them.
The Paris raid in 2022 revealed the same pattern, but with a twist. French police raided what was officially registered as a Chinese cultural center and found surveillance equipment, detailed files on Chinese dissidents living in France, and evidence of coordinated operations with counterparts in other European countries. The files included photographs, address histories, family contact information back in China, the kind of comprehensive dossier you'd expect from a domestic intelligence agency, not a cultural exchange program.
The cross-border coordination is the part that should really alarm European governments. These aren't isolated stations doing their own thing. They're sharing intelligence across national boundaries. A dossier compiled in Paris might inform an approach in Berlin. Surveillance footage from Amsterdam might be cross-referenced with social media activity monitored in London. It's a network, not a collection of independent nodes.
What's striking across all these cases is the consistency of the method. Whether it's London, New York, Paris, Amsterdam, or Sydney, the playbook is the same. Use diplomatic or cultural cover. Embed in the diaspora community. Identify targets through WeChat and social networks. Build pressure through passport control and family leverage. And crucially, stay just ambiguous enough that host governments struggle to build a prosecutable case. By the time investigators have enough evidence, the officers have often been rotated out or the station has been quietly relocated.
The rotation piece is important because it speaks to how institutionalized this is. These aren't rogue officers freelancing. They're on official rotation schedules. They come in, serve their tour, go home, get replaced. That requires a bureaucracy behind the scenes managing personnel, assignments, intelligence handoffs. This is a program, not a series of incidents.
The diplomatic immunity angle is the shield that makes all this possible. These officers often travel on diplomatic passports or are attached to consular staff in ways that make them difficult to touch. Even when a host country identifies an illicit station, the process of shutting it down involves delicate diplomatic negotiations. Expel the officers, and Beijing recalls them quietly and sends replacements. Shutter the station, and it reopens under a different name 6 months later.
There's a whack-a-mole quality to the enforcement problem. You find a station operating out of a commercial building. You shut it down. You expel two officers. 6 months later, there's a new station in a residential apartment, three neighborhoods over, staffed by two different officers who arrived on different diplomatic credentials. The operational capacity isn't degraded. It's just relocated.
China has over 600 diplomatic missions worldwide. That's an enormous infrastructure for cover. An officer can be listed as a cultural attaché at a consulate, do legitimate consular work half the time, and spend the other half running operations out of an unmarked apartment 3 blocks away. The dual-use nature of these postings makes them extremely difficult to distinguish from legitimate diplomatic activity.
600 missions is a staggering number when you think about it in operational terms. That's 600 potential hubs, each of which can host multiple officers, each of whom can run multiple operations. The scale of the infrastructure far exceeds what most host countries can monitor with their existing counterintelligence resources.
That asymmetry is the fundamental challenge. A country like the Netherlands might have a counterintelligence service of a few hundred people, focused primarily on Russian and Chinese state espionage targeting Dutch government and industry. They're not staffed to monitor every Chinese cultural attaché who might be running a side operation against Chinese dissidents. The resource mismatch is enormous.
What Daniel's really asking, beneath the operational details, is how a country like the UK polices this. And the core challenge is that traditional counterintelligence is built to stop foreign spies from targeting your country. But here, the targets aren't British citizens. They're Chinese nationals on British soil. The crime, if you can call it that, is China enforcing Chinese law extraterritorially. That's not espionage against the UK in the classic sense. It's something stranger, a sovereignty violation that doesn't fit neatly into existing legal frameworks.
That's exactly the jurisdictional blind spot that makes this so difficult. When MI5 does counterintelligence, the whole framework assumes a foreign power is trying to steal British secrets, recruit British assets, compromise British institutions. The targets are British. The harm is to British interests. But here, the targets are Chinese nationals. The harm is China enforcing Chinese law, and the violation is against British sovereignty, not British security in the traditional sense. That's not a gap in the law. That's a category the law wasn't built to recognize.
It's almost a sovereignty crime rather than a security crime. China isn't stealing British state secrets by pressuring a dissident in a London flat. But they're asserting that Chinese jurisdiction follows Chinese citizens wherever they go, and that British territory is just another operating environment for their public security apparatus. That's a direct challenge to what sovereignty means.
It creates a practical problem for agencies like MI5. If they catch a Russian intelligence officer recruiting a British civil servant, the case writes itself. Espionage, national security threat, clear path to expulsion or prosecution. But if they catch Chinese officers intimidating a Chinese dissident, the legal question becomes, what exactly is the crime under British law? False imprisonment, maybe. But proving those charges against individuals with diplomatic credentials in a way that sticks is extremely difficult.
This is where I think the legal systems of host countries are genuinely struggling. They have laws against stalking, against harassment, against intimidation. But those laws were written for domestic contexts. An abusive ex-partner, a criminal gang, a workplace bully. They weren't written for foreign state agents operating under diplomatic cover and targeting non-citizens for political reasons. The law sees a square peg, but the hole is round.
The knock-on effect might actually be more damaging than the direct operations. These stations don't need to physically grab every dissident to succeed. They just need the diaspora to know they exist. Once the Chinese community in London or Sydney or New York understands that Beijing has eyes and ears in their neighborhood, that officers can show up at your door and confiscate your passport, the chilling effect does the work for them.
It's the panopticon logic. You don't need to watch everyone. You just need everyone to believe they might be watched. A handful of visible operations creates a blanket of fear that covers the entire diaspora. The station in London doesn't just affect the woman in that apartment. It affects every Chinese dissident in the UK who sees that footage and thinks, that could be my door next.
I've spoken to researchers who study diaspora political behavior, and the pattern is consistent. Chinese nationals abroad who might otherwise be politically active. Writing op-eds, organizing protests, funding opposition movements, they self-censor. Not because they've been directly threatened, but because they know their families back in China are vulnerable. One visit from a community liaison who casually mentions your parents' names and where they work, and suddenly you're not so eager to post that critique of the party on WeChat.
The family leverage is the darkest part of this. These officers don't need to threaten you. They can simply note that your mother's residence permit is up for renewal, or that your brother works for a state-owned enterprise, or that your cousin's business license requires annual approval. None of those are explicit threats. All of them are unmistakable messages.
The cruelest part is that the threat doesn't even have to be carried out to work. The officer doesn't need to actually call anyone in the local government back home. The mere fact that they know these details, that they've done their homework on your family, is enough. It demonstrates reach. It demonstrates capability. The imagination does the rest.
What have host nations actually done about this? The diplomatic responses have been escalating. The UK expelled a Chinese diplomat in 2024, specifically over these police station operations. That's a significant step. Diplomatic expulsions are one of the sharpest tools in the toolkit, short of breaking relations entirely. It signals that London considers this more than a bureaucratic annoyance.
It's worth noting that diplomatic expulsions are inherently escalatory. When you expel someone's diplomat, you're inviting a reciprocal expulsion. Beijing will almost certainly respond by expelling a British diplomat from China. So the UK is essentially saying, this matters enough to us that we're willing to take a hit elsewhere in the relationship.
The Americans took a different approach. In 2023, the State Department designated these stations as foreign missions under the Foreign Missions Act. That's a clever legal mechanism because it forces them to register publicly, disclose their personnel and locations, and operate under State Department oversight or face closure. It doesn't outlaw them outright, which would trigger diplomatic retaliation. It forces them into the light, which for an operation that relies on secrecy is almost as damaging.
Beijing's response to the U.S. designation was telling. They insisted these were service centers helping Chinese citizens with paperwork. But if that were true, why not register? Why not operate transparently? The fact that China fought the designation so hard tells you everything about what these stations are actually doing.
If you're actually just helping people with paperwork, transparency is your friend. You want people to know where you are and what services you offer. The fact that these stations were hidden, unmarked doors, no public listings, no advertised hours, is itself evidence that they weren't service centers in any normal sense of the term.
The technological dimension is what's evolving fastest, and it's where the counterintelligence challenge gets even harder. These stations aren't just knocking on doors. They're using China's domestic surveillance infrastructure, facial recognition databases, social media monitoring systems, AI-powered analytics, and accessing them remotely from overseas locations. An officer in Sydney can run a license plate through the same system that tracks vehicles in Shanghai.
This is the part that worries me, because it means the surveillance capability isn't limited by what officers can physically observe. They're not just watching you with their eyes. They're running your face against a database of 1 billion-plus citizens, pulling your social credit history, checking your family's government records, all from a laptop in a rented office on the other side of the world. The data infrastructure of the Chinese surveillance state has been exported.
The 2025 case in Australia is the clearest example of this. Australian investigators found that a Chinese police station in Sydney had deployed AI-powered license plate readers targeting vehicles associated with Uyghur activists. These weren't Australian plates being monitored by Australian law enforcement. This was Chinese surveillance technology, operated by Chinese officers, tracking the movements of Chinese minorities on Australian streets.
That's where the sovereignty violation becomes undeniable. It's one thing to pressure a dissident in a private apartment. It's another to deploy automated surveillance systems that track vehicles through public streets in a foreign country. That's not community outreach. That's an intelligence operation with physical infrastructure.
The comparison to Russian compatriot centers in Europe is instructive. Russia has operated these for years. Organizations like Rosotrudnichestvo that position themselves as cultural and diaspora support networks. They do some of the same things. Monitor expatriate communities, cultivate pro-Kremlin sentiment, identify potential threats. But the Russian model is less aggressive. They're building influence networks. The Chinese model is building enforcement networks.
The Russians want you to think favorably of Moscow. The Chinese want you to know that Beijing can reach you. One is propaganda with a side of surveillance. The other is policing with diplomatic cover. The difference in intensity matters because it tells you what Beijing actually fears. Not foreign criticism, but organized domestic opposition that survives emigration.
That's the key insight, I think. Authoritarian states can tolerate foreign criticism. They can dismiss it as Western propaganda, biased media, imperialist interference. What they can't tolerate is domestic opposition that escapes their control. The dissident who leaves China isn't just a lost citizen. They're a potential organizing node for opposition that operates beyond Beijing's legal reach. These stations exist to close that gap.
If you're caught up in this, a Chinese dissident or activist abroad, and you get that knock on the door, what's the practical playbook?
First thing, and this is worth saying plainly, host nation police can intervene if you feel coerced. These officers may have diplomatic credentials, but they have no law enforcement authority on British soil, or American, or Australian. If they're threatening you, confiscating your documents, trying to physically prevent you from leaving, that's not diplomacy, that's a crime under local law, and you can call the police.
The diplomatic immunity argument cuts both ways. Yes, it makes prosecution difficult, but it also means these officers are operating in a space where any visible confrontation is a massive liability for Beijing. The last thing they want is a viral video of Chinese officers being questioned by local police outside someone's apartment. That's precisely why MI5 releasing that London footage was so damaging. It forces the operation into public view.
The practical advice from human rights organizations is straightforward. Document everything. Don't sign anything, don't surrender your passport, and contact local authorities immediately. Several groups have published specific guidance for Chinese diaspora communities. The Chinese Human Rights Defenders Group has been particularly active on this, maintaining a database of known station locations and operational patterns.
The don't surrender your passport point deserves emphasis. Your passport is the single most important document you possess as a foreign national. If someone asks for it and they're not a uniformed officer of the country you're standing in, the answer is no. If they take it anyway, that's theft, and you report it as such. The diplomatic credentials don't give them the right to confiscate property on foreign soil.
That's where listeners who aren't directly affected can actually do something. Organizations like Chinese Human Rights Defenders and Amnesty International have been documenting these stations for years, often with very limited resources. They're the ones building the public record that makes diplomatic pressure possible. Without their work, a lot of these stations would still be operating in complete darkness.
The policy piece is trickier, but the direction is clear. Host nations need to update their counterintelligence frameworks to explicitly cover extraterritorial enforcement of foreign law against foreign nationals. Right now, as we said, it falls between the cracks. Not quite espionage, not quite ordinary crime, not quite a diplomatic dispute. That ambiguity is exactly what Beijing exploits.
The U.S. Foreign Missions Act designation was a smart first step because it created a legal category that didn't require proving criminal intent. You don't have to prove coercion. You just have to prove they're operating as a de facto police presence without authorization, and that triggers registration requirements. More countries should look at that model.
There's also a multilateral dimension here that's underdeveloped. If the UK expels officers and they just relocate to France, and France expels them and they relocate to Germany, the network isn't being dismantled. It's just being shuffled around. A coordinated response across the EU, Five Eyes, or both would be much harder for Beijing to root around. But that kind of coordination is politically difficult and slow to build.
None of this is going to stop Beijing from trying. But making these operations visible, expensive, and diplomatically costly, that's the realistic goal. Every time a station is exposed and officers are expelled, the calculus shifts a little. The cost of doing business goes up.
That raises the open question sitting underneath all of this. What happens to international norms around sovereignty as China's global footprint keeps expanding? We've had centuries of diplomatic convention built around the idea that you don't enforce your laws on someone else's territory. That's bedrock stuff. But Beijing is essentially stress-testing that entire framework, and the rest of the world hasn't figured out a coherent response yet.
The framework was built for a world where sovereignty meant borders were hard and enforcement stayed inside them. China's betting that in a globalized world, sovereignty is porous enough to exploit. And the uncomfortable truth is they're not entirely wrong. If you have 600-plus diplomatic missions worldwide, and you can embed police operations inside a fraction of them, the sheer scale makes comprehensive detection nearly impossible.
It's a numbers game, and Beijing has the numbers. 600 missions, thousands of diplomatic personnel, a domestic surveillance apparatus that can be accessed from anywhere with an internet connection. The West is still trying to figure out how to respond to one station at a time, while China is running this as a global program.
Which means we should expect more of these undercover operations like the MI5 video. Host nations are getting better at detection. The London footage proves that. But Beijing is also going to adapt. They'll get more sophisticated about cover, more careful about operational security, maybe shift toward more digital surveillance and less physical confrontation. The cat-and-mouse game escalates.
The London video is a glimpse of what an effective counter-response looks like. Not just detecting the operation, but making it public in a way that's diplomatically embarrassing and operationally disruptive. That's the template. The question is whether other countries have the intelligence capability and political will to replicate it.
That's where we'll leave it, I think. a network of illicit police stations operating in over 50 countries, challenging the meaning of sovereignty, and a rare piece of footage that pulled back the curtain. The story's not over. It's probably just getting started.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing today's episode. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want more episodes like this one, find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The word crimson traces back through Arabic and Persian to the Sanskrit kirmija, meaning produced by a worm. Referring to the kirmes insect, a tiny parasite harvested from oak trees in Central Asia, including parts of modern Kyrgyzstan, whose dried bodies were crushed to produce a vivid red dye prized by ancient empires for royal textiles.
A worm-based dye called crimson. Of course it is.
See you next time.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.